Labyrinths is brought to you by Knox Robinson Productions. Please consider becoming a patron. For as little as $5 a month, you can listen to Labyrinths ad-free.
Visit patreon.com/KnoxRobinson to learn more.
I'm not thinking of it from the point of view of sitting in judgment and weighing the elements in play in each case. It's more the work is stained, and that stain is emotional. It's not a decision I'm making. So I would have liked to have seen Polanski be sentenced. Maybe. I don't even know. I haven't even really thought about it. The work is just changed, and there's not really a way around that.
Feeling lost?
Then you're in the right place.
I'm Amanda Knox.
And I'm Christopher Robinson.
And this is Labyrinths.
Can you still enjoy Thriller after learning what Michael Jackson did?
Or does knowing that Picasso was a misogynist asshole ruin your ability to appreciate Guernica?
The question of if we can separate the art from the artist, and whether we should, even if we can, has a long history. In the 1940s, a school of literary criticism arose called New Criticism that asserted that the work must stand alone, that considerations of biography should play no role in how we interpret or react to art.
The Argentine writer Jorge Luis Borges lampooned and dissected this idea in his short story Pierre Menard, author of The Quixote, in which a 19th century Frenchman manages to write the exact text of Don Quixote, originally authored in 17th century Spanish by Miguel Cervantes.
Menard does not copy Cervantes' text, but arrives at the same sequence of words independently. Borges goes on to assert that this is a far more impressive feat for Pierre Menard than it was for Cervantes, who was writing in his native language and time. It's an absurd and rather academic story that gets at the heart of this question. Does the biography of the artist affect how we react to the art?
That question is now far from academic and has become much more visceral and emotional and personal in the age of mass media and in the era of cancel culture. We are now routinely faced with a dilemma. News breaks that an artist beloved to us, a singer, an actor, a comedian, has done something horrible. How does that change our experience of their art?
There's no one better to help us explore this thorny territory than author Claire Dieterer.
All right, welcome to Labyrinths.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You are actually physically here with us, which is very uncommon, so sorry about the smell.
Are you talking about you?
Yeah. So would you mind for our audience and your audience, who are you and why are we talking to you today?
My name is Claire Dieterer, and I published a book this past year, my third book, and this book was titled Monsters, A Fan's Dilemma. And it was a book that looks at great art made by allegedly bad people and sort of what we do with it as the audience. So it sort of looks at these artists, but really it's about us and our experience of the art.
Great. I'm glad somebody figured out the answer to all these problems.
It's all answers. There's just nothing but conclusions in this book.
Yeah, no question marks at all.
Is this a question that has poked at you or haunted you for a very long time? Or was there a moment when it really came to the fore and you were hit by the urgency of this question?
Yeah. My previous book to this was a memoir called Love and Trouble. And in that book, I was writing a lot about my experiences of having been predated and molested when I was 13, 14, sort of that age. My experience of growing up in the 70s as kind of a predatory era for young girls. Mm. And I was writing it at the time my own daughter was 13. So thinking about that age and what it is to be a mother, and the book deals with some of these themes. But the book had this sort of funny form because the material was so heavy and such a bummer. I took different forms and played with them. Part of the book is an ABC, part of the book is a map. You know, there's all these different approaches. And one of the approaches is I wrote an open letter to Roman Polanski, sort of as this figure of predatory men. Mm-hmm. Of course, I don't know him, so he just ended up in my memoir via my imagination. But in order to write these two open letters in the book, actually, I researched his crime really thoroughly. Like, I read the depositions and I read the memoirs by both him and his victim. I followed up on every lead and learned everything I could about the case. And then when I finished writing the book, I was left with this shocking realization that I could still watch his films. So I started as a film critic, and I've always really, really, really loved Polanski's work, and it's been important to me. There were ways that the viewing was disrupted, but I could still do it. And I thought, well, that's really interesting. And this was in 2014 or 2015, so this wasn't a conversation. I thought this was just like my private crotchet, you know, sort of my own
as
problem.
As a film critic.
Exactly.
For those of you not familiar, celebrated director Roman Polanski, known for such films as Rosemary's Baby, Chinatown, and The Pianist, also drugged and raped a teen girl, Samantha Gailey, in 1977. We interviewed Samantha in episode 5 of Labyrinths, It's Okay to Be Okay, and her perspective on Polanski and his work after being assaulted by him is fascinating. But that trauma didn't merely affect Sam. It affected the entire audience for Polanski's films. But how exactly?
I love that you used the word disrupted, because I feel like that's a very accurate way of talking about this problem, because I think people say it either is ruined or it's not ruined. And you take the stance of like, well, I'm not going to tell you if it's ruined or not ruined. I am going to tell you that it looks different when you know certain things. Can you talk about how you've seen other people dissect this problem, and are they dissecting it, or is it more of just as a knee-jerk reaction?
Sidestepping it?
Yeah.
That's interesting, sort of having an immediate reaction as a way of sidestepping. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that the way that this gets talked about is barbelled in two different directions. And on the one end, you have people who are often men who say, you should separate the art from the artist. And in fact, the New Critics, who are these critics who wrote in mid-20th century, called the conflation of the artist with the art, they called that the biographical fallacy. So there's a hint that they didn't like it in the word fallacy. So any confusion of person and work was considered a fallacious way to look at art. And then on the other end, you have very strenuous reactions to biographies where somebody has maybe done something rotten, and that's it, we're getting rid of the work. Not even sort of looking at the problem of, well, will this person continue to work? Like, take a person like Louis C.K. That's not what I'm really talking about, is whether or not we decide that an industry is going to support this person as a worker, but rather, okay, that's it, I'm not watching old videos of him, or I'm not going to read a book by somebody who's been so-called canceled. So those are the sort of extremes. And for me, I was troubled by both extremes. In the second example, I just didn't want to give up all the work. I think there's something about middle age that has really brought me to even more deeply value the work that I love, and to be so glad when something touches me in a profound way like that. It's very hard for me to throw it away.
Mm-hmm. Having spent a lot of time consuming mediocre content.
Yeah, exactly. Very true.
When something gives you chills, it's rare.
Right, exactly. And I think, you know, when you're young, everything's new and fresh and exciting. So maybe love of the work is a little easier to come by. But as you get a little bit older, maybe it's rarer and therefore more valuable. So on the one end, that. But then in terms of the separating the art from the artist, that just seemed completely impossible to me. I mean, I remember I write quite a lot in the book about trying to watch Woody Allen's film Manhattan, mm-hmm. which is about a 40-something man having a relationship with a 17-year-old girl. Huh. Which is complicated.
Where do I know that from?
Why?
Yeah. Yeah, that's something familiar about that story.
That would be the fact that Woody Allen began a sexual relationship with his stepdaughter, Soon Yi, when she was around 21 years old.
And being told, well, you have to separate the art from the artist. And it's like, I'm not making a decision here. Mm-hmm. I'm not like, yes, right now I'm confusing the art and the artist. It's just happening. It's something that is involuntary almost.
Right.
This confusion. And so setting a stricture that you ought not to do it is just impossible.
Yeah. I love the way that you've sort of gone down all of the avenues of this. And one of these avenues is, okay, so can we appreciate the art if it's not actually in reference to the fucked up thing that they did? Like Wagner's Valkyries don't have anything to do with anti-Semitism. You know, it's a different thing when you see Woody Allen dating a teenager in his movies and also doing that in real life, or like Louis C.K. Masturbating to his audience and then finding out he did that in real life. And you're like, oh, I feel more covered in actual sperm now.
And the opposite issue, which you also bring up, that, you know, the character of Bill Cosby as Cliff Huxtable is so far away from who we know him to be now that
we feel lied to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the Wagner is the one that I think is hardest one to dismiss when people are like, yeah, I have no problem. Right.
Right. But do I find myself secretly judging someone who's like, who claims to be super into Wagner? I'm like, wait, are you like trying to say something by being super
right.
into Wagner?
Are you waving a flag at me right now?
Is that a dog whistle?
Yeah.
I do think Woody Allen and Bill Cosby make this really interesting pair because, like you say, Woody Allen's very similar. His biography is very similar to a bunch of the work that he's made. And then in Bill Cosby, there's this incredible gulf between Dr. Huxtable and what we know about him. And I think that they both make you feel covered in yuck in two different ways.
Don't yuck anyone's yum, but
I mean, I think that there's reasons to have responses to both of those for sure in these two really different ways. And then I write a lot in the book about the book Lolita, and we don't know that Nabokov ever like predated or preyed upon young girls. So he wrote about this theme more than once. And so that's another really interesting dynamic between work and biography, because in that case, it's almost as though the work is besmirching Nabokov's
reputation. He took on that creative risk knowing it would harm his reputation.
Exactly.
But thinking that the mindset of Humbert was worth exploring.
Exactly.
In detail. Yeah.
I think he knew that he risked being the monster.
Hmm.
And what was achieved through that? I mean, I think he achieved something great and something really important about this very subject. But that conflation was risky for him, as we see now, because there's people who won't even read the book.
One thing I was actually really curious about, I wrote this down actually, that we have a sneaking suspicion of our own badness at the heart of our fascination with people who do awful things. And you were talking about this in reference to moralizing about art and people who create art. But that immediately made me think about a subject I get tangled into all the time, which is true crime. And what is up with the fascination with true crime and people's obsession with criminal figures and their crimes? You know, what you stated was something that I even was quoted as saying in the Netflix documentary, which is it's a way of us pointing out who's the good guys and the bad guys. And we're definitely on the good people side because we are the ones who are obsessively watching the bad ones and like judging them and enjoying the judgment of it. And that's a way to draw a line in the sand. And so I think that impulse to judge is also a safe house for ourselves because we're safely on the side of judgment and not of being judged. But at the same time, is it because we also secretly have a feeling of badness in ourselves and we're sort of making sure that we're on the side that we want to be on? I thought that was fascinating. But the thing that actually it reminded me of was this controversy that happened a little while ago. Poetry Magazine published a special issue where it invited people in prison to submit work and they published their work. And great. They had people, murderers on there, rapists on there who were serving time or had already done their time and were being published and had interesting things to say.
And it comes from this very progressive impulse to humanize the incarcerated.
And
these
rehabilitate.
Are people too, right?
And like this idea that you get a second chance as life and maybe that second chance for a criminal is as an artist. And is that allowed? But then it just came to a head when one of the people that they published was someone who had been accused of child pornography. And like all of a sudden,
How dare you publish that guy?
The whole community became like, how could you possibly publish somebody who had child pornography? And it was a poem not about child pornography. Mm-hmm. But, like, they were totally fine with, like, rapists and murderers, right, but not with the child pornography. And so, like, just this confusion. I was watching from the sidelines going, wow. Anyway, I'm just curious to know if you followed that and if you have any thoughts.
I have so many thoughts. I just think it's fascinating, first of all, that there is one status of person that we decide will always be cast out, right? So even coming from this truly abolitionist, progressive impulse to publish this work, which I'll say more about in a second. But even when we're doing that, we still create this out-group so that we still get to have what you so well described as a safe house sort of inside ourselves, where we are not that. And that is victim-aware, progressive, left-leaning casting out of a group. And obviously, the behavior of that group is terrible. But casting people out doesn't usually work out very well for women, for poor people, for queer people. All of these people, when we create a dynamic where people cast out, historically, that isn't great for us. One of the things I come to in the book toward the end is this sort of interrogation of my own badness. What is it that I have done that's wrong? And I start to look at this through the lens of my own sobriety. And the problem as a sober person about pointing fingers at the bad guys is that we are the bad guys. Mm-hmm. We are the people who've done rotten things. If we hadn't done rotten things, we would still be drinking because we fucking love it. Right. Right? So there's a reason we had to quit. And so I think sober communities tend to have a really complex and really interestingly evolved relationship to what we call cancel culture. But in general, even though there is a lot of abuse in recovery circles, right, and that abuse does get called out, there's still this very healthy mistrust of the othering of the abuser. Mm-hmm. And I think that for me, that idea of not necessarily even rehabilitation, nothing that sort of programmatic, but that idea of the humanity of the other and this unavoidable humanity of the other and of myself, the ordinary humanity we all have, became more and more important to me and more real to me as I was writing the book. This trans writer I really admire, Grace Lavery, described the book as a portrait of a radicalization, which was like the greatest thing anybody said about the book. And I know that Bill Ayers of The Weathermen had the same response to the book, that at the beginning, I'm looking at the problem from more of a, like, this person's wrong, they need to get in trouble, which was my experience when I started writing the book.
Right.
And then because of the history we lived through between 2015 and 2022, because of my own personal history I lived through, I started to look at the problem much, much more from a systematic point of view and less from individuals doing wrong. I began to see more and more that this focus on individuals doing wrong was, to me, not the thing to focus on. The humanity that exists in each of us, it's crucial that we recognize it. And, you know, I work a lot with Books to Prisoners. So I go into the basement of the program every week and send a bunch of books to a bunch of incarcerated people who are looking for something to read. And it's really important that I don't become preoccupied by what they did. Mm-hmm. It's really important that I'm connecting with the interior self that's like looking for a Louis L'Amour novel or wants to grow bonsai or whatever it is that's going on with them. I've been thinking about this a lot lately, the validation of interiority that comes with Books to Prisoners or that comes with prisoners making art. It's just this affirmation that we all have interior life. And that is the core to being human. And that when you take that perspective, then the idea of the monster sort of looks a little different.
We could give you lots of reasons to support Labyrinths on Patreon, including ad-free episodes and exclusive patron-only content. But why not hear it direct from a listener?
My name is Henry, and I've been a supporter of the Labyrinths podcast for some time. I can totally relate to the concept of feeling lost. And I think the stories have helped me tremendously getting through these last couple of years. And I think they would help others as well.
Visit patreon.com/KnoxRobinson. We were going to ask you about your thoughts on this Bryan Stevenson quote. And we often return to this line of his that is, each of us is more than the worst thing we've ever done. He said that in reference to people on death row that he's defending. And you could equally apply that to Roman Polanski or Louis C.K. or
Cosby. The trick, you know, though, is, or can you, because how do you feel differently about the fact that some people went to prison and some people didn't?
Well, and that's what I was going to ask is, like, yes, more than does not mean not a murderer, right? It's like you're still the guy who committed that horrendous murder, but you're also much more than that.
Yeah.
And you have this interiority and this humanity and all this other stuff.
And you also like to grow bonsai.
Well, I mean,
when someone's paid their dues, right? When they've taken their, whatever the society has decided the punishment is, and they've gone through that path, does that change it for you? If Polanski or if Louis C.K. or if any of these figures that come up in your book, you know, is there a point at which you say, okay, you did your time, all is forgiven, I can enjoy your art now? Or is it forever a stain?
So for me, I'm not thinking of it from the point of view of sitting in judgment and weighing the elements in play in each case. It's more the work is stained, and that stain is emotional. It's not a decision I'm making. So I would have liked to have seen Polanski be sentenced, maybe. I don't even know. I haven't even really thought about it. The work is just changed, and there's not really a way around that. The way that biography is inescapable now. That's one of the things that I really set up at the beginning of the book, is that when we encounter someone's biography, it's not by choice. When I was a kid in the 70s, if I wanted to learn something about a writer or an artist, I had to go to the library.
Yeah.
I mean, like, how, you know, it was really hard to find out information. And I talk in the book about my boyfriend who was obsessed with the Beatles. He would just go to the bookstore and he'd sit by the rock biography shelf and just hope that a Beatles biography would show up. And now, of course, biography just falls on our heads. And so the things that I know, I'm not even really sitting in judgment of. And in some ways, I don't even know I know them. They're just osmosis-like entering my consciousness. Hmm. Biography is, I mean, in many ways, it's what our economy runs on, because it's what the internet runs on. So my relationship to it isn't something where I'm seeking out information or making decisions. It's more like an emotional response, or a response to the weather, is the way I would describe it.
When you talk about biography, what comes to mind is the person in their entirety, bio, right? I think of the book on the shelf. It's their whole life, you know? It may be the case that there's one act that that person has done, which is the thing that has stained their artwork, say. Is there a difference? What is that difference, if so, between the act and the person? Is it the person that you know them to be who's capable of that act that's doing the staining? Or is it the act itself? Because if the person can prove that they've changed, say, they're no longer the Bill Cosby who did all that, and you can really believe it in the way that people in recovery community, like, you can really believe, like, you've changed. It's not unstained, necessarily, if they've changed.
As I say in the book, if I didn't believe people could get better, why wouldn't I just be like a drunk in an old cartoon with the XXX bottle? You know, the idea of change is inherent in any elastic idea of what it is to be human, but certainly within recovery. I don't think it's necessarily, as a consumer of art, my responsibility to take on board that person's change. For instance, the guy who made Community, Dan Harmon.
Yeah.
He wasn't a sex pest, but he created an environment that was uncomfortable for women who were working for him, I think was the accusation that came forward.
Right.
And he wrote this apology that I'm speechless, because it was an actual apology, right? Like, he actually acknowledged everything that happened, acknowledged that he had done harm somehow in the midst of all that, didn't center himself. And So I think that supports your point of view because it does. I love Community.
Me too.
It's such a good show.
And I think that that tenderness is in the art in that case. Like the way that he sees his characters is really tender. But if he hadn't written that apology, I don't know if I'd feel quite the same way. So that's an example of exactly what you're talking about, where I saw somebody go through that process and respond to it in such a rare and beautiful way that kind of took the onus off me, like made me not to have to sit here and have this dilemma that we have over and over. He's like, I'll take the hit. You watch the show, right?
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
It just occurred to me how this biography problem, I think, is exacerbated by an economy of authenticity that we have, which is like, be authentic, sell your authenticity, unless it's the wrong authenticity, and then you're canceled. And what you think about this idea of cancel culture, does it exist? Does it not exist? Is it a weird terminology? What does it mean when it comes to the way that we are consuming each other's art, but not just each other's art, each other's lives, and our lives are now art?
You know, some people do get canceled. It's true. I'm not saying that doesn't occur, but I'm really troubled by the terminology. I think that when a cancellation happens, it's because somebody, often a woman, raises her hand and says something shitty was done to me. And what follows is what we call cancel culture. So the question then becomes, do we want to risk people not speaking up so that we can't have things go off the rails in the ways they sometimes do? That was actually one of the hardest parts of this book, is I had to sit there and like try to run that calculus and kind of come up with, I think we have to support a culture where people say what's happened, because as one of my children said, if we don't do that, how do we get better? I did this event in Chicago. It was older readers than I usually talk to and wealthier. It was the University Club. It was very posh. It was high in a building above the lake, and it was a wood-paneled room. And we had a very lively Q&A after the event. And this woman raised her hand and said, cancel culture has our kids in its grip. My daughter is just a victim of cancel culture. And I was like, okay, well, what do you mean? She said, my daughter's 22. I was sitting in the TV room and she came in and she got me in trouble. She started reading me the Riot Act. And all I was doing was sitting there watching a movie with Fred Astaire in blackface. And I just, like, it was like everything in your story made sense until the last line. Clearly, your daughter was trying to connect with you around why that's not okay. I think that her daughter is coming to her and is sort of shocked by what she's seeing, because it's a little shocking. And, you know, maybe it feels hostile, but is trying to have a conversation. So I think a lot of times you do hear cancel culture used by people who are my age or maybe a little bit older about their kids. And I feel like, what if we shifted and saw it as people trying to give us information? People trying to talk to us.
That's interesting. I think you would probably agree with me that this was definitely an example of cancel culture run amok, which is when I was going through everything I was going through with me, people found out who my mom was and were writing into the school district trying to get my mom fired because she's my mom associated with student on trial for murder. And like people who came out in my defense, other people in the online community going and trying to get them fired from their jobs, which it feels unfortunate that like so many different things get grouped into this one idea cancel culture
is.
That's
what I was going
to say. Because on the one hand, we're trying to have a conversation about like differing mores. And then on the other hand, there's like going in and trying to screw up somebody's life because you think they're associated with a bad person.
You look at examples in like John Ronson's book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed, right?
Yes.
There's the Justine Sacco type situations where somebody does a flippant tweet, or the poor guy who was accidentally making the okay sign. He's a Hispanic guy, blue collar worker. He was sitting at a stoplight, resting his arm out the window.
Just kind of like fiddling
with his fingers.
You know,
and
going like
a group of progressive protesters walked by, saw him, took a photo of his hand doing the okay sign, put it up on the internet. And then this guy gets fired from his job, et cetera. He's a
Hispanic immigrant.
Yeah.
Right.
And it's like, you think he's a white supremacist? that phenomenon is a very different phenomenon than people calling out Harvey Weinstein.
Right.
And we shouldn't have one term to talk about those two things.
I think that's really smart, because obviously the situation with your mom, even if she were, you know, a nightmare, would still be not okay.
Yeah.
And I do think that your point about it's too many different kinds of actions caught under one umbrella. And if you are the person who's on the receiving end of that, I think that the reactive thing is then to say all cancel culture is bad. But what I think is interesting to think about from a feminist point of view is what is achieved by calling all these behaviors cancel culture. Who isn't going to speak because of that? And it's really effective in getting people not to speak.
One thing I wanted to get your thoughts for the audience, just to tantalize them further to read your book, is when you talk about the difference between ethical thoughts and moral feelings.
It's a perfect example, the call about your mom. That's a moral feeling. They might think they're having an ethical thought. They think they're like, this is wrong and I'm going to do something.
Right.
But they're just really in the grip of this idea that calling someone else wrong is going to make them more right. Calling someone else not okay is going to make them more safe. When you are pointing your finger and when you're calling someone else a monster, I think that somewhere in there is the knowledge of one's own badness. Why else would you be pointing over there? So there's some kind of self-hatred or guilt that's sort of happening in that moment, even though it's completely unconscious.
I tend to think of it as like there's a lot of things being projected onto me that are not actually from me, and I'm just sort of absorbing all of whatever you have going on inside of you. It's interesting to find oneself to be that blank slate onto which people can do that.
In defense of the monster-seeking impulse, I could...
it's so fun.
I definitely think there's this tribal in-group, out-group thing happening. Mm. I could also see there being a deep evolutionary origin here, in the same way that we are fascinated by stories of disaster and harm, because it's very useful to know how your cousin or friend or someone else in your tribe got harmed so that you can avoid that same harm. Like, you are really incentivized by natural selection to want to know that.
Yeah, I think it's the megaphone of broadcasting.
Yeah, and the availability from an entire global culture that puts that in front of you.
Exactly. So I think that you're no longer speaking to your tribe. You're
exactly.
speaking to everyone. It's this massive category error we all live with every day, where we think we're having an exchange with each other. I wrote in the book about parasocial relationships and this idea that we have these relationships with public figures or the blank slate, you know, that you were talking about. And they feel real. And that parasocial relationship, that idea, the sociologists who talk about it trace it all the way back to the first days of radio. Say I'm standing in a room and I'm speaking to 50 people. We all know what's happening in that moment. If I'm speaking into a box in your house, suddenly we don't know what our relationship is, and we sort of have never figured it out. And so I think the same thing goes with this idea of our tribe and protection. We're broadcasting something that maybe is better said.
There's no feedback mechanism in that radio example. And I think one of the interesting problems now is that there is a big feedback mechanism through social media.
Mm-hmm.
And that leads to an entirely different problem of audience capture.
Yes.
Where people will be very attuned to the chattering voices of their Twitter, Facebook, whatever audience, and then double down on the things that get them the most ratings and views, which tend to be outrage-inducing, you know, provocative, et cetera.
Right. And that dialogue or that chatter can look like gossip. And why is gossip powerful? For women and for outgroups, the whisper network is crucial for exactly what you're talking about, this idea of exchanging information that you need to know about, well, that guy, stay away from that guy.
Stay away from him, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm texting you and telling you that, that's a very different dynamic than if I'm subtweeting someone.
Yeah.
And so it is that broadcasting and then the feedback loop that turns into this noise, which is not at all the same thing as this powerful tool that gossip can be.
what are we doing when we say we? Is there a we? Is there a consensus? Is there authority? Or is it just every single person for themselves?
I talk in the book about this idea of we being this tool that's sort of pressed into service when the speaker wants to have more authority for their moral feeling. So if I sort of am having a reaction to something or whatever it is I'm doing, if I start to use the language of we, it's a way of giving myself power and authority and disowning the individual response that then makes me vulnerable to critique. And the book is, it's not meant to be a defense of individualism. I think that the concept of the we, when it's encompassing collectivity or listening, is crucial. But in terms of an aesthetic relationship, I think that the individual response is authentic. You know, I thought a lot with this book about bringing in figures from other fields. And I've been asked a lot about this, like, why aren't there figures from business or sports or politics?
Science.
I mean, all of these places have had their reckonings over the last few years. And the reason I stayed focused was partly the book couldn't be 5,000 pages long. But also, there's a unique dynamic at work between the audience member and the artist. The artist has to express herself with the faith that the audience will find her, and she has to express herself from this actual authenticity, not performed authenticity. And the audience member responds privately. I mean, this is the thing we forget, is you're experiencing art inside yourself, right? And there's so much assertion of what you should like or what's okay or what's not okay, that dynamic with the art that's just you experiencing it, just you alone in your house reading or listening to music or whatever, becomes invalidated. And a lot of what I wanted to do in this book was lift up the importance of the individual aesthetic response. And it actually is sort of the key to everything I'm trying to achieve here, which is funny because I think my politics are much more collectivist. But in terms of art, I think that if we can lift the subjective, then we have a hope of allowing art by different groups to rise. We have this hope of allowing different kinds of criticism to rise. We have a hope of moving forward in a more multi-voiced manner where we hear from more people and we consume art for more people. When I was working on the book, I was obviously just thinking about this question all the time, and I kept not finding any writing or thinking that felt meaningful to me until I read this piece of writing by a woman named Pearl Clegg, who wrote an essay called Mad at Miles.
As in the legendary jazz musician Miles Davis.
And in that piece, you can tell it's a really emotional individual response by the title, because she has the word mad in it. And then she writes about falling in love with Kind of Blue and learning, after she was already in love with the work, about what Miles's abusive behavior toward women, his self-admitting. And she was furious because she had loved the work. She was furious because she felt betrayed by him. She was furious because she had survived abuse. She was furious because she's a Black woman and she didn't want to be angry at a Black man. All of these things came from her own subjective experience. And when I read that, I thought, oh, this is it. This is what I want to do. This is what I want to be around. This is what I want to read. You know, all of a sudden you're stepping out of that kind of like ethical posturing and really being inside the subjective experience and the moral response. And it wasn't that after I read that, I thought, now I'm going to have the same opinion as Pearl Clegg, right? I didn't think, oh, now I feel the same way about Miles Davis. Instead, I felt, oh, now I see it's my job to stand in my subjectivity and say what I think and feel, and thereby allow the audience member to do the same, each reader to do the same, to come to that dialogue thinking about what their own subjective response is, which is a really hard place to write a book from in a lot of different ways. But to just stand there and be like, yes, I'm a middle-aged, middle-class white woman, and I'm going to be subjective about this, it was really scary.
Yeah, I was thinking about the other domains you mentioned, and everything you just said strikes me as things you can't really say about science and business. they're not subjective and emotionally charged in that same way.
Like you wouldn't just decide not to get a vaccine because the person who developed it was,
well, you know. I mean.
Or would you?
Exactly.
I'm thinking of like if Einstein was a womanizer, it doesn't change whether or not his theory of relativity is true. Mm-hmm. It's just true or not. And we can verify that. And you know, it doesn't matter how much of a womanizer Rockefeller was, he might be a great businessman.
You kind of can't help but be like, you're undeniably a genius.
Not only
bastard.
Is it sort of not subjective that way, like you can just look at the numbers and be like, yeah, that guy was an incredible businessman.
Or the same thing with sports even.
So there's that part. But then also like people don't tend to develop an emotional relationship with the theory of gravity the way they do with Kind of Blue. So there's something special about when an artist does a monstrous thing because you already have opened the sort of emotional floodgates.
I think it's also one of the reasons we get so much bullshit about how you're supposed to feel or how you're supposed to respond, because the model we're talking about is here's this person who did something great and they did at least one rotten act. But how do we know the work is great, right? There's this shifting kind of perspective on whether or not something's truly great. And I wrestle a little bit with that problem in the book, but the problem of what makes something great is thousands of years old. And so that's one of the reasons that we're just sort of barraged with this just either strong-arming, saying, well, we separate the art from the artist, and Manhattan's a work of genius, or, you know, this idea, well, it's not worth keeping around if the person did a rotten thing, right? Like, it's worth nothing, it's worth everything.
You know, one of the things about the cancel culture thing that has always rankled me is, even if it is accountability culture, even if it's the particular example you're discussing is one in which someone genuinely has done something that is some degree of icky. We have very important safeguards in our institutions for a reason. We have due process, we have the right to face your accuser, we have standards of evidence, and they're super flawed and they mess up and they need to be reformed and all of that. But I'd rather have them in place than have no standards. And that includes proportional sentencing. It's an ideal to aspire to that our system fails to implement. But when the mob comes for you, even when you've done something wrong, none of those safeguards are there. There's no right to face the accuser. There's no guarantee of proportional sentencing, all of that stuff. And so you run into situations where someone has done something, but there doesn't seem to be agreement on what exactly should happen to that person.
And then it's just Wild West.
That's exactly, I mean, that's what I was saying. It's this calculus between empowering victims and then what seems to be the situation we're in, which is the Wild West. I think that you've brought up, first of all, this idea of what happens to the person in the middle of that. They become this screen almost that stuff gets projected onto. And I think that we all have that, actually, that experience in the current world we live in. It's almost like being a parable for the experience of being perceived online. So there's that piece of it. And there's stuff that I've seen you talk about before that has to do with the nature of gender in the middle of that experience. Who is it who gets piled on? Who is it who somehow maybe has that for a while and then it passes? Who is it who has that happen and experiences a lessening of status but still maintains some of their power? I totally hear what you're saying about the mob, but it's also really interesting about the shifting nature of the person at the center of it.
Yeah. How many women in the 90s who were taken apart by the tabloids, how many of them get to have a career afterwards?
And it's funny, we don't use that term to talk about what the tabloids did to Britney or whatever, right? And not just the tabloids, but all the readers, all the masses of people judging those women. Is that cancel culture?
I think it seems like the term is used to disempower people from speaking up.
Maybe I want to return to this idea of authenticity, because it's deeply tied in with biography. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really anchored in our present moment. You know, the questions you grapple with, like, say, Polanski, like, you could have been grappling with those in 1980, right? And they're still relevant in the same way, but there's a new dimension now when we're all living our lives on Instagram.
Or TikTok, if you're a kid.
I know, I sound so old.
On Facebook.
Yeah. On MySpace.
We're all old.
Yeah. the authenticity factor has been ratcheted up, I think, in our current moment.
Even AI makes me think of this, how more and more our value as human beings is coming under question. And the only economy that we have left is the economy of our authentic selves and how much that authentic self appeals to a wide audience and how much we can sell it. Like, today is the Super Bowl. And today, Taylor Swift is going to go watch her boyfriend throw a ball around a field. And the event itself, the sports game, is that event that people are paying for. But a lot of people have been spending a lot of money to consume the very fact that Taylor Swift is going to go watch her boyfriend throw a ball around a field. And that is that economy of authenticity. We're not just consuming her music, we're consuming her life. And we all are sort of moving in that direction. And how does our feelings about someone's biography play into that? I mean, it feels like it makes it even more like their life is the art. Therefore, how we feel about their life is the value. So it makes this whole argument ever more absurd because we've just gone into this realm of ridiculousness.
Once again, it's always worth stopping and saying, who's making money off this? I think that the whole thing, the whole internet, the whole engine runs on this, exactly what you described, this authentic biography, not just biography, but the unmediated experience of the other. And the unmediated expression of the self. What happens is that art and the publicly lived life become conflated. And you've written a memoir. You know that they are not the same thing, right? That you make the piece of art and you are thinking of the reader. You're having an imaginative experience as a writer. You're taking your life and shaping it into story. And then when I come to read your book, I'm hearing your voice. I'm engaging with you in this one-on-one way. It's a made thing. The madeness of it is what's beautiful. If you just put your journals there, I mean, maybe that would be interesting for a while.
Right. But so, then after a while, I'm just complaining about being prison again.
God, I'm still here.
Day 1000.
Yeah. I mean, which as witness is kind of interesting.
It's my Ulysses.
The life, the bio part of this is so often also curated, though, right? Like, it's just, there's this lie that we all kind of engage in from the person on both sides of the TikTok account, right? The celebrity is selling you the lie that you're getting a window into their authentic reality, and it's a highly curated selection of what their life is like. And you are sort of suspending disbelief that you're getting that window into their authentic life.
You're lying to yourself.
Right. And so it is a made thing. The Instagram accounts, the TikToks, those are just as much curated art feeds as the memoir or the album is, in a way, for people who are at that profile, that level. But there's a kind of commonly accepted, I think, denial of that. We want to believe that this is different than the album, that you're witnessing something about that person's life that isn't as composed. It's not the memoir.
But that make-believe that I'm experiencing their lived life is what makes it not commensurate with the album or the book, which lives inside the formality of its own artifice. And so I step to that and I'm like, okay, I know this isn't how Amanda Knox experienced this exact experience, but she shaped it into a thing and we're both participating in the fact that it's made. It's almost anti-spontaneous. I think that probably there are things happening in those realms that probably are art projects.
Right. Yeah, I think about the art of the selfie and how now there is truly an art to the selfie and like, how do you arrange the picture and how do you hold it and how do you shape your face and what filter do you use? Like, there is all of a sudden an artifact that's being made. It's just a picture of yourself.
Yeah, whether you're doing it correctly or not.
We're long past the stage of James Franco just laying in bed taking a picture of himself.
Right. Yeah. How delightfully, you know, nostalgic.
Speaking of James Franco, I've been thinking about this breakdown of art that a friend and I came up with a long time ago to talk about music in specific, but I think it could apply to many forms. And at first, we thought, like, you know, music is too broad a term to describe, like, why I like Bob Dylan and why I like the Ramones, say. And we came up with Wordzik, Tunzik, and Tudzik. And, okay, I like Bob Dylan's Wordzik. He's got great words. His music is pretty good. Yeah. It's not the reason if the words sucked and it was just that same music, I would probably listen and go on to the next thing. And then there are some bands that the primary thing you're going there for is the attitude. Mm-hmm. It's the energy. It's not the brilliant lyricism. It's not even the music. It's the energy and the attitude. And I think that's true of many arts, that the attitude one in particular bleeds over into biography. Mm. And so who a person is, who James Franco is, who Robert Downey Jr. is, whatever, that idea of that person in the world is a big part of the draw and appeal. And I think Taylor Swift is a great example of this, that her attitude and the image of herself that we all have access to when we see her cheering her boyfriend on from the box at the Super Bowl, that has nothing to do with the songs. Right? But it's a big part of the draw of her as an artist is the attitude. And the attitude is in the songs.
Right. Just like the attitude of Dan Harmon apologizing is in the tenderness of community.
Maybe this problem comes more or less into focus depending on how much of an artist we appreciate for their Tudzik.
Hmm.
And if it's very low for an artist, if the primary thing I'm getting out of them is some really fine-grained, you know, control of language or something, if someone is just like a brilliant manipulator of syllables.
I mean, that's the problem that I have with Eminem, because he's so good at rapping and he's such a jerk. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point, right?
Yeah. I think that there's these cultures that pop up around the attitudinal, you know, either artists who are really driven by attitude or who are only driven by attitude, or who happen to have a good attitude that goes along with a really incredible artistic achievement. You know, there's an energy around that that's often generated by young girls. And so I think that, you know, on the one hand, you can look at those people as being manipulated by a corporate culture. On the other hand, if we think about the mob rising up and being this horrible thing that we experience over the internet, at the same time, there's girls around the world interacting through these boxes of light, saying what they love, what they love, what they love. And so there is this incredible giant art project happening that has more to do with the audience, which is always more interesting to me, than it necessarily has. Like, Taylor Swift's fine, but the dynamics around Taylor Swift are fascinating.
Yeah.
And young girl driven and have always been thus. And so it will always be that these artists who have the adulation of young girls are maybe going to be less respected.
I mean, it's really hard to untangle that back and forth, that feedback loop, right? I mean, I'm just thinking of that Bo Burnham song. What's that? What's the name of that song?
Repeat Stuff.
Repeat Stuff, yeah. Where he's talking, but he's dissecting how a pop song works. And my favorite line from that is, "I love your eyes and their greenish, brownish, bluish color."
Yes.
Right?
Just like you're any girl.
Just like eyes.
Right? Like
you have eyes.
It is simultaneously a corporate pop machine designed to appeal to those young girls because that's where all the money is. And it's also the manifestation of the collective urges and desires of that group.
You're giving them what they want.
Right. We want the love song.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
They are shaping it, but so is corporate America shaping it. They're both shaping it. Right?
But it's also totally okay to want to take a break. Like, I had this very weird experience when I was in New York this past spring where I accidentally met Carrie Brownstein, and we were talking, and I guess Slater Kinney had done a show the night before, and they had a free day in New York. And she said, "I am just walking around the city trying to find some art I know nothing about." And I just thought that was, I've been thinking about that for a year. Just this idea that she had set aside a day to encounter work, whether it was music, visual art, whatever. The refusal, the stepping away from the phone, the stepping away from context is at this point, it has to be a choice. I mean, I don't want to be the, you know, advocate for Ludditeism, but I do think that there's something about the quality of attention and the quality of love that we bring to art that is almost sacred And it does become eroded by constantly being caught up in these dynamics we're talking about. What could be more eroding than filthy lucre, right? You know, we started talking at the beginning of this conversation. I said, there's not that many things I get to love. So I am really interested in protecting this little secret meadow that is my attention, right? And at least having it available to me.
Yeah, my final question would be to kind of bring back to the theme of our podcast here. Mm. If you felt lost in that conundrum at the beginning of this journey, did writing the book and spending countless hours pondering these questions about the art of monstrous figures make you feel any less lost?
Yeah, actually, I think it did. I think that there's that quote from E.M. Forster. He said, how can I know what I think till I see what I say? Hmm. Which, as sort of a relentlessly logical nonfiction writer, even though I have lots of digressions, I always am driving toward understanding. So spending years driving toward that understanding was just an incredible thing to get to do. And trusting that the reader would come with me was really scary. Mm. But I do feel like I got to do that. And I also got to see, once the book was finished and I looked at how different I was at the end of the book than I was at the beginning of the book, through the ways my perspectives changed, I got to actually witness some political, intellectual, and emotional growth in myself, which was shocking. So it was actually one of my kids that pointed it out. He's like, this person is not the same as this person.
If you'd like to experience some political, intellectual, and emotional growth in yourself, consider checking out Claire Dederer's book, Monsters, A Fan's Dilemma, available wherever books are sold.
It's both an incisive exploration of this dilemma at the cultural level and a deeply personal reflection on Claire's own inconstant status as a fan of such art. We can't recommend it enough.
In the meantime, get lost with us. Find us on Twitter, at Amanda Knox.
At Man Under Bridge.
You can learn more about our work and how to support it at knoxrobinson.com. And despite popular accounts, I didn't do the monstrous acts attributed to me, so I hope that you have no internal struggle about leaving Labyrinths a 5-star review.
Labyrinths is brought to you by Knox Robinson Productions. This episode was written and produced by us. Our managing producer is Andre Sapp, our production assistant is Jasper Merrill, and our theme music is by Josh Budo Karp.
Captain's Log, Stardate 89361.5. We've encountered a fascinating alien civilization. The people of Patreon Prime are humanoid in appearance, but possess vastly greater degrees of nuance, compassion, and intelligence than any race we have so far encountered. But what is perhaps most striking is their generosity.
Captain, the warp core is going critical.
Warning.
Divert all energy to patreon.com/KnoxRobinson.